Here's Americana.
Because it is situated geographically at the crossroads of America, Chicago has played host to millions of transcontinental travelers, mostly for an hour or a night. Shunted past teeming industrial smokestack jungles, through slums of great magnitude, and along a shoreline of startling gray beauty, passengers stop over only long enough to board fresh planes or trains. Then they're gone with the wind. The great metropolis of the prairie soon dwindles behind them. Yet, here and there among the wan faces at the windows of the transports, one sees questioning looks, eyes that stare out at the city hungrily. What kind of a place is this? The glances ask. What is this town?
The words you have just heard were written by Albert Halper in his introduction to the anthology, This is Chicago. This program is Americana, the 18th in a series of radio essays on the American scene, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight, in part transcribed, we bring you Chicago.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. We're all hag-ridden by the necessity for definitions. What we ask is love. What is life? What is death? What is a city, a nation? And when we ask these questions, we are by no means always certain what sort of answer we wish to receive. Sometimes it's an answer phrased in the terms of living experience. And sometimes we only want more words to define the words that puzzle us. When, for example, we talk about the cities that dot the American continent, we have only two or three modes of discussion open to us. We can talk about a city like Chicago, for example, in terms of our own immediate recollections. We can say, this is how it was when I lived there. This is what I remember. This is what it was like. Or we can, on the other hand, write a history of the city, which is based in the long run upon the experiences of other people, set down usually in books. Or, if we're philosophically inclined, we can try to tell what a city like Chicago is like under the light of eternity. The differences from history to experience to philosophy, I think, are admirably suggested in this passage from Albert Halper's introduction to his anthology called This is Chicago.
Chicago has never been nor tried to be a city like New York, London, or Paris. It has always been loudly and vociferously itself. Though it strikes out at the one-day or one-hour visitor bluntly, like a huge fist, it possesses a subtle inner complexity that almost always escapes even the most discerning out-of-town eye. Its facade of jukeboxes, beer joints, and trancing, smiling women who parade on runways practicing the fine arts of syncopated bumps and grinds for conventioneers coalesces into a gigantic paper billboard behind which the real city of Chicago breathes and lives. Past the windswept litter of Michigan Avenue, beyond slanting shadows thrown by the tall spires of the downtown section known as the Loop, 4 million people whose tragedies and comedies are bound up with this puzzling giant of the plains work, sprinkle their lawns in summer dust, bury their loved ones, worry over the price of meat, and adjust their television sets of an evening. Because it is situated geographically at the crossroads of America, Chicago has played host to millions of transcontinental travelers, mostly for an hour or a night. Then they're gone with the wind. The great metropolis of the prairie soon dwindles behind them. Yet, here and there among the wan faces at the windows of the transports, one sees questioning looks, eyes that stare out at the city hungrily. What kind of a place is this? Glances ask. What is this town?
Well, then, this is the city. This is Chicago. The plaster of Paris facade with canned music and sound effects supplied by history, behind which the millions of quiet lives go on. Whatever we say about the big town is always fragmentary, always a vignette drawn from history or philosophy or life. Here's one of the latter. Not long before Christmas, I received a charming letter from a lady named Anna Harkness, who said that she'd been listening to these programs and then went on to tell me something about her life in Chicago.
I don't think you know how rural Chicago was 75 years ago. I was born in the West Side, and we moved to the stockyards when I was a year old. We lived two blocks from the floor where they have the stock show now. We had no movies. We climbed the stairs to the water tower in the stockyards, and we thought we could see the Story Mansion at 43rd and Michigan Avenue. We had no water, had to go two blocks for our water until the city put water in our street. We had a wonderful mother. She bought a two-room house and it had to be moved across the street. We paid $5 a month for just one lot. But my mother had half the block and a garden. She bought a cow for $30. We had geese, ducks, and chickens, and one pig. For a while, we didn't like the pig. We didn't have to buy any food but flour and sugar and apples. My mother made all of our clothes. There were three girls and two boys. My father only earned $50 a month. My sister and I had to take the wheelbarrow every morning when they made beer and get the grains for the cow. I had to work after school and received $1 a week. I had to quit school in the sixth grade.
This letter from Anna Harkness is a reply from Mr. Halper's tourists. What is Chicago like? Well, it is, or it used to be, a place where you kept a garden that stretched for half a block, where you had ducks and geese and chickens, and a pig that frightened you a little bit. A place where you climbed the steps of the water tower to look clear up north to 43rd and Michigan. But of course, this was in the old days. There are so many old days in the history of a city like Chicago, most of them long past recovery. American cities have grown so fast, changed so much. There has been such violence and terror in their lives, along with the serenity and the peace. And maybe the raucousness and the serenity blend sometimes, occasionally, once in a while, into a song.
Back of the yards, back of the yards, in old Chicago town, where each fellow and gal is a regular pal. They never turn you down. Where an ace is an ace, anytime, any place, you'll always get their best regards. And I feel mighty proud, and I'll holler out loud that I'm from back of the yard.
Perhaps it's appropriate to travel by way of the stockyards from these peaceful and happy recollections of rural Chicago to the gaudy facade of Chicago history. A good deal of the Chicago facade is devoted to politics, and among the most extraordinary of Chicago politicians is surely William Hale Thompson, one-time mayor who secured his niche in American intellectual history by threatening to bust King George on the snoot. Thompson's biography, under the title Big Bill of Chicago, has just been published by Lloyd Wendt and Herman Cogan. Here's an episode in a Chicago political campaign in those days when Mr. Thompson was first running for mayor.
On the Friday before the election, Marion Drake, a feminist who tried in vain to defeat bathhouse John Coughlin in the first ward, announced a new meeting of her Can't Stand Thompson Club in Cohan's Grand Theater. She declared the meeting open to every party and invited all candidates to speak. Hundreds of Miss Drake's followers marched on the Grand for her rally. They arrived to find the theater filled with Thompson rooters yelling, "All for Chicago and all for Big Bill!" The girls fought their way in and sat in the aisles. When Miss Drake yelled for order, she was drowned in a wave of howling and stamping. Miss Drake presented Seymour Stedman, the socialist candidate, but he was yelled down. She introduced John H. Hill, the prohibitionist candidate, and a contingent of women in the front row leaped up to shrill, "Let us rescue all Chicago from the awful curse of drink. Let us save the helpless drunkard who is struggling on the brink." "That's right," bellowed Hill. "We'll sing Chicago dry."
talk it dry and vote it dry.
The startled Thompsonites permitted him a few words and then started their jeering and catcalling. Schweitzer, Thompson's chief opponent in the campaign, stepped out to speak while a few brave partisans chorused, "Ice cream, soda water, ginger ale, and pop! Schweitzer, Schweitzer, always on top!" Good-naturedly, Schweitzer began, "This is like a football game." Well, he got no farther. The theater roared with sound. Outside, a crowd of 5,000 pushed at the theater doors, shouted threats, and taunted the police guards. A woman who yelled, "We want Big Bill!" was pummeled, and it took 7 policemen to rescue her. As tension mounted, someone turned in a fire alarm for the theater. Trucks with sirens screaming bore down on the crowd outside, and mounted police tried to clear the way. Scores were knocked down and trampled. Outside the theater, the Thompsonites surged into the pro-Schweitzer crowd, and fighting broke out. The rival partisans pounded one another while firemen fought to get space for their hose line and equipment, and police swung their clubs, bawled commands, and sought to disperse the crowd. "The scenes of disorder were unparalleled in political history," reported the news. This was the sensational climax of the campaign. It might have been a terrible tragedy.
It's always fun to read the histories of Chicago. A pleasant but misleading experience. Life in the history books is a colorful affair, full of political flim-flams, public riots, machine gunnings, and general corruption. The histories convince us that life in Chicago must be a very turbulent affair. Those of us who live here know that by and large it isn't. It's rather hard to suggest the relationship between the facade of Chicago and the bungalows and flats and cottages that lie behind it. Or rather, it would be difficult, except for one of Chicago's most distinguished citizens, Mr. Martin Dooley, philosopher and barkeeper of Archie Road. Mr. Dooley's opinions, and if you're not familiar with them, you should correct that situation at once. Mr. Dooley's opinions were recorded some 50-odd years ago by Finley Peter Dunn. Mr. Dunn's other deeds are, I suppose, dust and ashes by now, but Mr. Dooley, like Socrates, is a deathless figure. And I trust that he'll always remain so. For Mr. Dooley was a man who knew how to take life in his stride. He lived, for example, through a number of political episodes not unlike the Thompson campaign, which we just mentioned. And through his discussion of them, he became, for his time, a sort of intellectual mediator between the average man and the tumults of history.
Mr. Hennessy, wearing a silver-painted stovepipe hat and a silver cape and carrying a torch, came in, looking much the worse for wear. The hat was dented, the cape was torn, and there were marks on Mr. Hennessy's face.
"Where have you been?" asked Mr. Dooley.
"Marching," said Mr. Hennessy.
"By the looks of you, you might have been the light of march for the parade. Who's been doing things to you?"
"I had a currency debate with a man by the name of Joyce. Give me a high glass of beer. I'm as dry as a gravel roof."
"Well," said Mr. Dooley, handing over the glass, "well, you're an old man, and as the good book says, an old fool is the worse yet. So I'll not try to convince you of the error of your ways. But why any citizen that has things in his head should dress himself up like a sandwich man, put a torch on his shoulder, and toddle all over this blessed town with his poor round feet is more than I can come at with all me intelligence. Now, I agree with you perfectly, Hennessy, that this here is a crisis in our history. On one hand is arrayed the Shylocks and the Patriots, and on the other side, the Patriots and the Anarchists. Oh, now the Constitution must be upheld. The government must be maintained. The downtrodden farmer and working man must get their rights. But do you think, man alive, that you're going to do this by pouring lard oil from your torch down your spine? Or tripping over streetcar tracks like a dray horse trying to play circus? Is the Constitution any safer tonight because you have to have your leg amputated to get your boot off? Or because Joyce has made your face look like the back doorstep of a German restaurant?"
"Well," said Mr. Hennessy, "well, anyhow, I proved my hatred of capital."
"So you did. So you did. And capital this afternoon showed its hatred of you. You ought to match blisters to see which hates the worst. Capital is at home now with his gams in a tub of hot water. And when he comes down tomorrow to oppress labor, he'll have to go on all fours. And as for you, Hennessy, if it'll age you any, you can hang for a few minutes from the gas fixtures. Tell me, did the Gould Democrats have a parade? No, said Mr. Hennessy. No, but they reviewed the day's procession from the Palmer House. Both of them was on the stand.
In the biography of the great city, the gaudy and resounding march of history and the slow movements of private lives come together at one point, catastrophe. In the history of Chicago, this means the Chicago Fire, the Great Fire of 1871, the flames, the tumult, the tragedies and terror. And then, a few days later, the city rebuilding.
Chicago, having once raised itself out of the mud, turned to the chores of creating a new city over the ashes of the old. Poetic tributes from Bret Hart, Will Carlton, John Greenleaf Whittier, and many an amateur were spurs to these efforts. From the city's prolific songwriter George Root came a series of tunes on the same theme. Lost and saved, from the ruins our city shall arise, and passing through the fire.
Flames, flames, terrible flames, how they rise, how they mount, how they fly. The heavens are spread with a fierce, lurid glare. The red heat is filling the earth and the air. While mercy, mercy, we hear the despairing ones cry. We are passing through the fire. Passing through the fire, and it is our Father's hand, though we may not understand why we're passing through the fire. Passing through the fire.
Wagons hauled bricks from the ruins to the lakeshore basin to make ground for a large lakefront park. Other teams dragged the ruins of the courthouse north of Clark Street to provide a more solid base for that busy thoroughfare. Thrifty Presbyterians took the tar-stained stones of the Second Presbyterian Church and used them for their new church building in Lake Forest. New and more solidly constructed buildings began to appear above the jagged profile of the downtown area. In the Kendall Building, George H. Johnson used the first hollow tile floor construction and thus made complete fireproofing possible. Architects flocked to Chicago, drawn by the rare opportunity to remake the city.
This description of the rebuilding of Chicago is from Emmett Dedman's new book, Fabulous Chicago, which is one of the best social histories of the big city that I have seen in a long time. I quoted this particular passage because I suppose that this point in Chicago's history, the rebuilding after the Great Fire of 1871, must always be considered the city's greatest moment. It's also the point in time which divides the frontier town from the modern metropolis. Also, according to Mr. Dedman, this was the time when the ladies brought the usages of high society to the lakefront.
The chief characteristic of Chicago society was its newness. Most hostesses had little experience in entertaining formally. A guest from Boston was horrified to find her Prairie Avenue hostess serving dessert ices in the center of calla lilies, a horticultural innovation more magnificent than appetizing. More conservative hostesses relied on the catalogs of the fashionable caterer Kinsley for instructions on how to manage a high tea, a coffee, or an at-home. Kinsley's was Chicago's most fashionable restaurant and aspired to the title of the Delmonico's of the West. From his restaurant, Kinsley issued the catalogs which determined the proper etiquette for Chicagoans in such matters as afternoon reception, society jewelry, the art of dressing, and the etiquette of the ballroom.
And, of course, Mr. Dooley, who knew an intellectual pretense when he saw one, had his word on the limitations of simplicity when on one occasion he discussed a book called The Simple Life.
Well, I see where Chaz Wagner has been having the fine old time over here, said Mr. Dooley. Oh, is that the man that wrote the music? Asked Mr. Hennessy. No. That was Cal. This is Chaz Wagner. He's the author of the 200,000th book that President Rosenfeld has read since the 1st of November. It is called The Simple Life. He couldn't find it in France, so he come looking for it amongst the civil, simple and pastoral people in this country. But he found it. He come over in a large but simple ship of 20,000 simple horsepower and landed in the simple village of New York, where he was met by a committee of simple little village lads and lasses and escorted to the simple Waldorf. And there he was installed in a room simply decorated in purple plush. That evening, he attended a meeting of the Fifth Avenue Female Simplicity Club, and a lady wearing a collar of diamonds whose value was simply fabulous recited passages from The Simple Life. After this, a simple supper of terrapin and champagne was served. He then took a simple Pullman train to Washington, where he attended a reception, at which a lady of the diplomatic corps, which is all that's left of diplomacy nowadays, poked the wife of a congressman with her lorgnette for going into supper ahead of her. Later, he was received by the simple president, who said to him, "Chaz," he says, "Chaz, I've been preaching your book to me countrymen. Simplicity and a strong navy is the watchword of this administration." "Now, I haven't read his book," said Mr. Dooley, "but Hogan says it's a good one. And I'm going to read it after I've read the Bible and Emerson, which Mike Ahern recommended to me the year of the big fire."
"Come all you bold sailors that follow the lakes, on an iron ore vessel your living to make. I shipped in Chicago, bid adieu to the shore, found a way to Escanaba for red iron ore. Down, 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 derry down. This packet she howled across the mouth of Green Bay, and before her cut water she dashed the white spray. We rounded the sandpoint, our anchor let go, we furled in our canvas, and the watch went below. Down, 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 derry down. Next morning we hove alongside the Exile, and soon was made fast to an iron ore pile. They lowered their chutes and like thunder did roar, they spouted into us that red iron ore. Down, 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 derry down. Some sailors took shovels while others got spades, some took wheelbarrows, each man to his trade. We looked like red devils, our fingers got sore, we cursed Escanaba and the red iron ore. Down, 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 derry down.
There is too much variety, too much color, too much fascination in the story of Chicago. The song you just heard, for instance, suggests the whole fascinating prospect of the story of the lake steamers, the ore steamers. We've said nothing about that. We've also said nothing of the railroads that have built into and out of Chicago, and certainly nothing of the Indian days, of the times of the French explorers, or of the crude pioneering life in Chicago before the fire. Perhaps anyone's version of Chicago, if it's at all accurate, will turn out to be a kind of overlay with times and events and characters superimposed, as it were, one on the other. Something of this notion I read into a delightful book by Mr. Leonard Dubkin, entitled Wolf Point. Mr. Dubkin is a Chicagoan, and his book is, as he describes it, a kind of imaginative adventure in Chicago history. Mr. Dubkin takes as the locus of his story a little patch of ground which extends into the Chicago River not far from the merchandise mart from which I'm now speaking to you. This little point of land, called Wolf Point, has, in Dubkin's opinion, a kind of affinity for miracles. Whoever is willing to go out through the parking lot which lies below Orleans Street and out onto Wolf Point may even yet, he says, have a mystic and inexplicable change worked in his life. And to prove his point, he tells four stories from the history of Chicago in which people widely separated in time have experienced this strange thing. It's a part of the very end of Mr. Dubkin's book which I wish to repeat to you, partially because of its curious suggestion of the telescoping of times and events, which I just suggested was characteristic of any attempt to write Chicago history. Here, then, is Mr. Dubkin's final portrait of Wolf Point. And perhaps, too, here is a kind of symbolic portrait of Chicago.
It was a day in late October that I left my office in the Merchandise Mart, walked down the ramp to the railroad bridge and across the tracks to the path leading down the embankment. I walked to the end of the path, then, pushing aside the tall stems of last summer's weeds, I made my way toward the point of land at the fork of the river. After a few minutes, a peculiar thing happened to my vision. At first, I thought my sight was becoming blurred, but I soon realized that everywhere I looked, I was seeing not one object or scene, but a number of images superimposed on each other, like the ghosts one sometimes sees on a television screen that is not properly tuned. Across the river, I could see the end of the tunnel from which trains sometimes came, and a large warehouse and the glistening railway tracks. But at the same time and at the same place, I could also see Wolf Tavern, with its crudely lettered sign swaying in the wind, and behind it, on a little hill, the frame house that John Wright had built for his wife Kitty and himself. I could look up to the top of the embankment and see the front bumpers of the cars in the parking lot. And yet, in some strange way, I could also see the embankment going up beyond the parking lot to form a high, flat-topped mound with a wigwam and four stone altars, and a circle of poles stuck in the ground on its top. In a sudden flash of intuition, it occurred to me what was happening here beside the river. Or perhaps it was happening only in my own mind. Time had been erased for me. It had ceased to exist. And I was seeing everything that had ever been here now and in all the ages past. And it seemed to me that someone or something was trying to communicate a message to me. It is all true, it seemed to be saying. It all happened just as you have set it down. There's a spell here, and these are the people, now and in times past, who have felt its magic touch. You have been listening to Americana, the 18th in a series of radio essays dealing with American history and American living, presented by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Maloney. Direction is by Ralph Knowles. Songs and ballads are by Chicago's well-known balladeer, Wynn Strachey. The quoted materials were read by Claire Baum and myself, Bill Grisky. Books mentioned on tonight's program were Leonard Dubkin's Wolf Point, published by G.P. Putnam Sons, Emmett Dedman's Fabulous Chicago, published by Random House, Big Bill of Chicago by Lloyd Went and Herbert Cogan, published by Bobbs Merrill, and Albert Halper's This is Chicago, published by Henry Hope. The quotations from Mr. Dooley were from Dissertations by Mr. Dooley, published in 1906 by Harper and Brothers, and from Mr. Dooley in Peace and War, published in 1898 by Small, Maynard and Company. This is the NBC Radio Network.